Good morning. You're listening to Morning Edition on Rhode Island Public Radio. I'm Elizabeth Harrison. It's official. The National Weather Service says we're going to get hit with another snowstorm this weekend, the third in as many weeks. The Weather Service expects the snow to start falling sometime on Saturday and continue overnight and into Sunday. National Weather Service meteorologist Charlie Foley says the snowfall accumulations will depend on the exact track of the storm.
It is clear that most areas, including the coastal areas, will receive snow. Probably on the order of 2 to 4 inches near the coast, well inland, the higher elevations, 6 to 12 inches.
Besides the snow, there's a possibility of strong wind gusts on Sunday, and there's also a slight chance of more snow on Tuesday night. Forecasters say they will have more information later today. The Rhode Island chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union says state attorneys general have not been doing enough to ensure access to public records. The ACLU has released a report showing it's rare for the attorney general's office to file lawsuits against public bodies, even after finding violations to the Access to Public Records Act. The ACLU says more aggressive enforcement is needed to help reverse a culture of secrecy in Rhode Island government. A spokeswoman for the current attorney general, Peter Kilmartin, calls the findings myopic and one-sided. She says Kilmartin supports revisions to the open records law and is training state officials to better comply with the statute. The incoming head of the Rhode Island Airport Corporation says two main priorities are increasing flights at TF Green and getting the most out of the Interlink Transit Hub. Kelly Fredericks is a civil engineer with experience as a private pilot. As Rhode Island Public Radio's Catherine Welch reports, Fredericks is currently overseeing expansion at the airport in Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
Kelly Fredericks has held leadership positions at airports in Pittsburgh, Harrisburg, and Erie, Pennsylvania. He's currently with a consulting group managing the construction of a new terminal down in Florida. Chair of the Airport Corporation Board, Kathleen Hittner, says Fredericks' experience overseeing runway expansion and with coalition building landed him the job.
He's built relationships with airlines, and he's very keen on building those personal relationships with our other leadership team and our employees.
Hittner says there was a rich applicant pool to pick from, but notes of the 35 applicants, only one was a woman. Frederick starts April 8th with a salary of $255,000. Catherine Welch, Rhode Island Public Radio.
Passenger traffic at TF Green Airport was down last month. The latest numbers show slightly fewer than 252,000 people traveling through the airport in January, a drop of 2%. Overall, the number of passengers at TF Green was down roughly 6% in 2012 when compared with 2011. And bidding has reached $60,000 for the bloody sock from Curt Schilling's star turn on the mound during the 2004 World Series. The Auction House Heritage Auctions will close the bidding at midnight on Saturday. They're expecting the sock to fetch upwards of $100,000. Schilling is selling his piece of baseball history to recoup personal losses from failed video game company 38 Studios. The business's collapse left the former Red Sox pitcher with personal debt. It also left Rhode Island taxpayers on the hook for a $75 million loan that came with a state guarantee.
Thank you. We're joined as usual by Rhode Island Public Radio political analyst Scott McKay. Hello, Scott.
Good morning, Rhode Island.
And University of Rhode Island political science professor Maureen Moakley. Good morning, Maureen.
Hola.
We're pleased to welcome back as our special guest, physician, educator, and talk show host, Pablo Rodriguez. We should also note he's a member of our board of directors at Rhode Island Public Radio. Hello, Pablo.
Saludos, amigos.
Rhode Island's Democratic Congressional Delegation is helping to host a Washington fundraiser on Monday for independent Governor Lincoln Chafee. The governor says this doesn't mean he's any closer to becoming a Democrat. Scott, so if that's the case, why would leading Democrats be helping the Republican turned independent raise money for a reelection campaign?
Well, it's some local Democrats. We don't see Treasurer Raimondo on there, of course. It's for the Washington delegation. It's people that Chafee has helped himself. Even though he got defeated by Sheldon Whitehouse, he endorsed him when he ran. He endorsed David Cicilline. He's obviously with Jack Reed. They served together in the U.S. Senate. I also think that Chafee's a comfortable guy for these people to work with. He's not a threat to any of them. They all get along pretty well, and I don't think he has that ambition on his sleeve that he's ever going to want to run for U.S. Senate, for instance.
Pablo, you've been a Chafee supporter in the past, and you served on his transition committee after he was elected governor. Do you expect him to become a Democrat, and would that help him?
I think it would help him in that just imagine President Barack Obama coming to town to do a fundraiser for the Democratic primary candidate, Governor Lincoln Chafee. I mean, I think that the potential for incredible amount of dollars to come into a re-election campaign if he ran as a Democrat from national sources, in addition to local sources that would want to support him, want to be loyal to the Democratic Party, could really make a very big difference.
Maureen, to play devil's advocate, why would it be in Chafee's interest to get into a Democratic primary with what looks like a field of Gina Raimondo and Angel Taveras and Ernest Almonte?
I agree. I don't think it's a good strategy. Here's my take. My take is this. 20 minutes after the gubernatorial election, Lincoln Chafee will become a Democrat, win or lose. If he wins, he'll become a Democrat because he's not going to have to run again. If he loses, he'll become a Democrat and get an appointment with the Obama administration. So I don't see him making any move as far as the primary and the general election because it's going to be a 3 or 4-way race. But after the dust settles, after the general election is over, I expect he's going to become a Democrat.
Well, speaking of the 2014 gubernatorial race, State Treasurer Gina Raimondo is bringing in an experienced campaign operative, Andy Roos, as her new chief of staff. This is a further signal that Raimondo is serious about running for governor in 2014. Maureen, do you think it's appropriate for the treasurer to put someone on her payroll as a state employee who is a political operative?
Well, the point is that many, many chief of staffs are political operatives, and the fact is one assumes that he's going to act as a chief of staff in a capacity working in the treasurer's office. The interesting thing about this is it tells us that perhaps, you know, similar to the dilemma that Chafee has, that Gina Raimondo may be going to take on Angel Taveras in a Democratic primary. One other strategy, of course, would be to have her run as an independent and avoid the primary. So this sort of suggests that maybe she's going to go this traditional route.
What do you make of this hire, Pablo?
I think that asking Dunkin' Donuts if they sell coffee and donuts, it's, you know, it's redundant. I mean, yes, political operatives are always part of the staff of elected officials because they all are interested in getting reelected. And the best way to get reelected is to get a head start by having those in the staff of their offices.
Scott, as we know, this reflects recognition by Raimondo that she needs some more political talent as she staffs up. Roos ran Mirth York's general election campaign in 2002. What is your view of him?
He's a good guy. He's a smart guy. I've known him for many, many years. However, he's not a government guy, and it's not appropriate for him to be on the public payroll, frankly, particularly when someone like Raimondo has access to so much campaign cash. I mean, she's raised a couple $1 million, and she can easily do it. You'd think that he would be hired to run the political operation paid for with campaign money rather than the taxpayers' money. But she's gone the other way. And the fact is, as Pablo said, no, it's not necessarily appropriate. But guess what? Everybody does it.
This week marks the 10th anniversary of the station fire disaster. Pablo, what do you see as the meaning of this for the state 10 years later?
I think it's a moment of reflection for all of us and a moment when we have to consider bills like the Congressman Langevin is looking to push in Congress for all buildings like nightclubs and housing for students and nursing homes to have sprinklers installed. It's hard to believe that 10 years later, we are still fighting this battle for the security of patrons in these institutions and locations. So I think it's a moment of reflections to see that we still have not gone far enough in this arena.
Scott, there's still a lot of raw feelings about this 10 years on. In a case where so many people died and so many were injured, was that inevitable that questions of justice would remain very much unanswered?
Yes, I think the Providence Journal and the Boston Globe did some very nice work recounting this in their 10-year anniversary stories. And I will say that obviously the pain is still, for a lot of these people, very, very tangible. The other thing that just astounds me is these Dedarian brothers, the people who own this nightclub, refuse to talk. They haven't ever settled their workers' comp case, which is out there for $1 million, and they don't seem to have acknowledged this, particularly Jeff Dedarian, a former reporter. I think it really, really irritates an awful lot of people out there, particularly those who had families and lost their loved ones.
Maureen, what's your takeaway from the 10th anniversary of the station disaster?
Well, I do think it's a time of reflection. I know one of our political science students was in that fire, and I think of him this week because of the fact that he's not here and he had such wonderful potential. The other piece of this is that at the very least, you know, instead of new legislation, although it might be needed, we ought to be really serious about enforcing quotas and enforcing the mandates. One of the lessons of the fire, we think, is that there were regulations that were not enforced, and that's a very important piece of what happened. And if we can only solve that problem, I think we've done something to at least acknowledge this great loss.
Let's stay with Maureen here. Across the board, federal spending cuts are set to start in March without a new budget agreement. How do you expect this to impact Rhode Island, and what will it take for Congress to avoid lurching from one budget crisis to the next?
I mean, I can't tell you what it'll take. I am completely astounded. I'm currently reading a biography of Lyndon Johnson, and I'm remarkably, you can see they go to breakfast. There's a lot of communication. The Republicans are losing this battle. But I must say, as far as Obama is concerned, the strategy of going out over to the public is a good one in the short term. But I wonder in the long term if more communication between the Hill and the executive might not be appropriate.
What do you say, Pablo?
I'm telling you, it's absolutely horrible. It makes me sick. There's 80,000 Head Start children are not going to be able to go to school. 2,500 defense jobs here in Rhode Island. 2,000 women in the WIC program are not going to receive benefits. 850 less immunized children. $17 million in research is not going to go to the hospitals and to Brown. This is a urgent call to all that we need to reach a compromise, and these cuts cannot be allowed to happen.
If the sequester goes forward, Scott, how do you expect it to affect the defense sector here in Rhode Island?
Well, it's really going to be a big problem. They're talking about furloughs, laying off civilian employees for at least a day a week starting in April. That's a 20% pay cut. I mean, you look at something like the Naval War College, our installation's electric boat down there. We have a fairly large defense industry, particularly all the subcontractors on Aquidneck Island. I know Governor Chafee's people are concerned about it because they figure the big companies will survive this. But the people who will be hurt and not get paid will be the small subcontractors, and they're all over southeastern New England.
How about this question of what it'll take for Congress to not lurch from one crisis to the next?
I hate to say it, but it's almost going to require some kind of realignment, because I don't expect the Republican Party to wake up tomorrow morning and say that this is like Paul on the road to Damascus and just have this epiphany.
You just came back from Vermont, Scott, and Howard Dean is saying the sequester would be a good thing to get a little bit of discipline on the defense budget. What do you say?
I think that Governor Dean, while a very smart guy, is not an expert in the defense budget. Look, this has the potential to cut off at the knees the recovery that's now going on in the economy.
Quickly, Maureen?
Well, I mean, I agree. I mean, I think why are we wasting all this energy? Even if it doesn't happen, it's so outrageous that with all the issues that we have, that all the energy in Washington is going towards this. It's appalling. It really is.
We're out of time, so we have to leave it there. Thanks for joining us, Scott.
Thank you.
Maureen?
Thank you.
And Pablo Rodriguez.
Hasta pronto.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Robertson Foundation, continuing the commitment of its founder, Stephen Hamblett, to honest government in Rhode Island through in-depth political coverage. And if you enjoy the conversation, please visit our On Politics blog at ripr.org.